step right up. The show's about to begin. Forget your troubles and raise your cups. Here's to this moment, it will never happen again.
This is Offstage and On the Air, performance number 612. I am Lisa Sheps. I am joined today by my co-host, as always, Miss Nicole Shiro.
Hello.
You are listening to us on KOOP HD1 HD3 Hornsby. This puppy streams live at koop.org. And during the pandemic, we are homegrown and pre-recorded. Stick with us.
Step right up. The show's about to begin. Forget your troubles and raise your cup. Step right up. Feast your eyes on the wonders of this world. Oh, yeah.
It's Liza with a Z, not Lisa with an S, because Lisa with an
S. It is Wednesday, April 14th, 2021. On the show today, we are fortunate enough to have Texas Performing Arts Executive Director, Mr. Bob Bursey. And then later on the show, we'll have the folks from Performance Platform Austin talking about their project. It's an exciting day. And of course, Nicole and I are going to talk about all the news that's fit to print. Hello, New York Times. Don't go away. This song, which I just love because it mentions Lisa with an S, which is kind of me. It is me on several levels. I'm Lisa with an S and I'm Lisa S. But we're playing it for a very sad reason. So we want to say rest in power to your dog, Eliza Minnelli, who crossed the Rainbow Bridge this past week. So I just want to pay tribute to her.
She did. And if you sang that song to her, she would spin and go nuts. She knew she was Liza with a Z. 16 wonderful years. Very, very blessed. She was a good egg.
Probably also a good dog. Did she like to eat eggs?
You know what? I don't know if she actually really liked the eggs. The other two used to, but she never really did.
So what is your favorite thing about Liza Minnelli, the dog?
She was pure love. Not a mean bone in her body. She would let other dogs pick on her, and then she would still love on them. And when the other dogs in the house were old, she was the little Florence Nightingale. She had a smile that went on for days, and she just loved. She knew if you're having a bad day and came over and gave you a kiss and went away.
Well, rest in power, rest in peace. She was a good egg, as you said.
She really was a good egg. She's now with her sisters with Brandy and Ellie. So they're all together now.
Okay. Well, on to other things and more Broadway-y things, even though Liza Minnelli is very Broadway.
She's very Broadway. And I appreciate you giving her a final performance with her number. I know she loves that.
Of course. We talked, I think, well, last week or a couple weeks ago, that Equity, in response to all the feedback they got from Equity members saying, please let us work, because they're the requirements for producers during this time were overly stringent. Things such as all actors had to be driven by a car service, a limousine service.
Yeah, I was about to say, I think it was a limo service.
Limo service.
Cars, but it's even more expensive than the typical just flat car service.
Right, and that singers had to be separated by 12 feet and a plexiglass shield. So those would be unattainable, not only financially, but also artistically. I think there'd be some issues around 12 feet separation. So, it's as if the Equity isn't paying attention to current news, because things are getting better. Their response to that was to hold a town hall.
Right.
And I, as an Equity member, was invited to that town hall and I attended it. So what we got was a lot of new news. Kate Schindel, the president, spoke. Oh, darn. I was hoping to, I didn't write down the names, but they spoke. There's about a half an hour of talking ahead of time in a presentation, which was completely unnecessary. It was a lot of information everybody already knew. And then there was a whole bunch of, there was a doctor that came on that talked about, what COVID-19 is and how it spread, which I thought was interesting. I mean, you would have to be living under a rock not to know that. But the Q&A session, which went on for about an hour, was a little bit more informative. But bottom line is,
nothing's changed.
Nothing's changed. And I don't really think that they answered the real questions that were out there, but they did talk about some of the requirements that they're some of the more level-headed requirements that they're requesting of producers, and they acknowledge that things are changing and things will change.
Okay. I mean,
now, which leads to the next thing.
And you could go one or two ways right now. I think I'm taking a guess. So where are you going on your next thing?
What are the initials that you're thinking?
Oh, initials?
Well,
are you going with the SR or are you going?
I am. No, I'm going SR. I have nothing about the pop-up really, other than he's one of the producers.
And so they brought it up at the pop-up.
Yeah, they're bringing it up everywhere. So the SR we're speaking of is Scott Rudin, who a big expose in The Hollywood Reporter reported what everybody has already known, that he is a terrible human being and he mistreats
tyrant.
He mistreats the people that he works with. Part of me goes, yeah, okay, it's good that they did this expose. It has had practically no effect. No major folks have been speaking out. And that's been some of the criticism for those major folks. But there's interesting arguments on both sides of that. So there are repercussions that affect people, like normal people, when other people speak out. Like they could cancel performances, which would.
Yeah, all the repercussions hurt the people that didn't do the bad. It hurt, and the other guy just still gets away with it.
Right. So I think one of the biggest people that hasn't spoken out is your friend Hugh Jackman, who has a show upcoming produced by Scott Rudin called The Music Man with Sutton Foster and himself. And that's set to reopen when, that was announced right before the pandemic.
And he's been on Twitter because he got his job the other day. And then he just had his 30th wedding anniversary with Deb. And I'm like, yo, buddy, are you going to address this? Or are you just going to just not say anything, Mr. Wolverine?
So I was listening to my Today on Broadway podcast with Matt Temenini, former guest of Offstage and On the Air. And he brought up an interesting argument, which was also not amplified. Daisy Egan wrote a blog post.
I was about to say, did you read Daisy Egan's post? Yes.
Yeah. So basically saying there are consequences. We need to understand and be generous to those that don't want to speak out. Don't criticize until you know the reason, because it can affect a lot of people. But the argument about Hugh Jackman not speaking out. So yes, if he spoke out against Scott Rudin, there would be a possibility of them pulling the plug on Sound of Music and all those people losing their work. Then the other argument is Hugh Jackman has enough credit, enough cred to find another producer and get it to open up. So people want him to speak up and he's not.
Well, it was interesting. I saw some different reporters write and say, this is exactly what we've all known, but we were never allowed to write about. And I'm going to write about it now, but where are the other reporters? So there is the reporters that could write about it. Press could do that and not get hurt other people. I'm sorry, people are going to get hurt from it and bad things are going to happen. But if you, when do you stop it? You either address it or you don't.
Exactly. And it's, you know, it's that well-known secret that's now out in the public. So now you have to deal with it. And so far it looks like he's going to get, you know, he's going to, you know, open
I mean,
right back up.
People shouldn't be having dishes thrown at them and being screamed at. I mean, period.
No.
I'd rather be on unemployment than have a dish and be treated disrespectfully.
I agree with you. Some people don't have that option. And that's the, you know, that's that therein lies the whole problem of the whole thing. But he's not the, you know, the first.
No, he's not the only one.
And he's not the only one that exists now. He certainly is not that, you know, David Merrick, who I've often equated him, was not the nicest person to work with as well. So, but we're in a new era where we're trying to treat people a little better. But there does have to be some give and take between. I don't even know. He shouldn't be acting the way he is. Period. End of question. Not only is he not good to work with from a human standpoint, I don't believe he's good from a marketing standpoint. He uses questionable business practices as well. So.
As I nod my head in agreement with you right now. So, and I honestly think he could say, I'm sorry, and people would accept it and let it go because of the way they've stayed quiet on everything else. I'm like, I think he could say, I'm sorry, and still get away with it.
Yeah, he might. But also, you know, his apology would probably be a non-apology.
Of course it would be. I mean, let's face it. Is he really sorry? Because he's still doing it decades later.
Absolutely not. So in honor of Mr. Scott Rudin, let's play from Annie Get Your Gun back in the 1940s. I'm a bad, bad man. Here it is. We'll be right back.
I'm honored. I'm flattered. This greeting.
That's a jazzy and Lisa Shubbs for that song choice today. You're on Fuego.
It was fun. Let's do this. Let's just run right into our first guest because I'm not sure how much, you know, I want to make sure we have time for everybody. You and I talked to one of our favorite interviews, one of our favorite people, Bob Bursey, who is running. What?
He's a doll.
He is a doll. And he is running Texas Performing Arts at UT. Which is, people know Bass Concert Hall is the biggest thing there. And he took over, I guess, a year and a half ago, and he's made some big time changes. And Texas Performing Arts is really taken a lead in the bigger venues, being part of the community, you know, it's with the small guys. So we see Bob and we see other people from UT quite often at our meetings. But Bass Concert Hall has taken this time to go through a pretty massive renovation when they just went through a massive renovation less than 10 years ago.
A
little over 10 years ago, I guess. But still, that's a lot. Let's listen to Bob Bursey, shall we?
Yes, let's.
And away we go. Well, we are fortunate here in the Zoom machine to have a Tony Award winner in our midst. Which is cool for us, right?
It's very exciting. Zoom.
We're happy to have Bob Bursey, the executive director of Texas Performing Arts, and the big poobah over there at Bass Concert Hall. Bob, welcome back, to Offstage and On the Air.
Thank you so much for having me. Hi, Lisa. Hi, Nicole.
Hi, Bob.
I'll tell you, before we talk about what you really are here for, I just, I don't know how I did not know this before today, but that you helped shepherd Oklahoma, or what people call dirty Oklahoma, onto Broadway.
Yes. People also call it sexy Oklahoma.
Sexy Oklahoma.
Neither of those things are exactly right. But yeah, we started it as a student production, actually. I was formerly the executive director of the Fisher Center at Bard College, which is in the New York area, and over a period of more than 10 years, took it from just the kernel of an idea workshopped with students all the way to a Broadway, Tony Award-winning Broadway production, and now hopefully post-pandemic heading out on tour across the country.
Yeah, well, I hope it comes here. As someone that's not a huge fan of the show, I was really looking forward to seeing this version of Oklahoma to change my mind. And that's what everybody says.
Yes, it's a complete reimagining of what that work is without changing a single word of it.
Yep. So great.
I'm hoping Ali Stroker goes out on tour with it. That's what I'm hoping. I'll just throw that out there. If you have any pull at all.
She is an incredible artist. That was one of the highlights of the Off-Broadway and Broadway production, was putting Ali in it. First actor who uses a wheelchair to win a Tony Award.
Yes, I know. Well, I'm thrilled. And maybe one day you'll come on and we'll do a show just about that. I would love to hear about the process from start to finish, which is incredible when you think that a student-run production can make its way to the Great White Way. So,
and we talked about that a few times about how this journey has been an incredible journey. So that would be great to get you back on one time to talk about that.
It gives hope to the rest of us, but we're not here to talk about that, Bob.
Other exciting news.
Well, the Bass Concert Hall, which just, I mean, relative to the world, went through a renovation back in, I think, 2006, 2007, somewhere around there, is at it again. So Bass Concert Hall is renovating. You want to talk about that a little bit?
Absolutely. I think these cultural facilities, theaters in particular, you just have to keep continuously improving them in order to have the level of comfort and amenity that we want to share with our audiences, and also have the systems up to date to be able to allow artists and designers to do their best work. So it is an ongoing, always work in progress. And what we're up to with this project is really taking a good look at the balconies. You guys probably know the Bass Concert Hall, largest theater in Austin, about 3,000 seats. And that's roughly divided 50% between the orchestra level and 50% between the balconies. Previous renovations really spruced up the orchestra level and got that into good condition. And with this project, we're going in and we're replacing the seats and fixing up the balconies, among other things.
Right, I had no idea. So this is the sad part about me. I have never been in the balcony level at Bass Concert Hall. Orchestra snob here. So I did not realize that they were the old seats. When I heard you were replacing the seats, I went, those are one of the things that were replaced in the past. But what I found interesting was the stuff that you're doing on the sight lines and the way those seats used to be. The way those seats used to be oriented. Talk about that a little bit.
Yeah, absolutely. So hopefully when you can come back, we'll get you to sit up in these amazing new seats up in the balconies. No, not happening. Okay.
Front row balcony, yes.
All right, fair enough. So what we're doing, one, is we're replacing the seats themselves, which are actually original to the building. So dating from 1979, 1980, 81, when the facility was under construction and open. So you imagine 40 years worth of people sitting in those seats. That's a lot of good hard use on those. So definitely glad to get those replaced. And while we were doing that work, we had the opportunity, really thanks to the pandemic in some ways, to be able to go in and rebuild the side sections of both of the balconies, where the seats sort of previously faced dead on straightforward. So you were looking more at the wall of the proscenium than actually towards center stage. So working with our architects and our engineers and our theater planners, we've now curved the rows in the balconies. So you'll have a nice arc and a good view right towards the stage.
I should tell our listeners that if you go to the texasperformingarts.org, you can see a lovely video that stars one Bob Bursey in the featured role in the video. And you get actually a good architectural rendering of what those seats look like now. And it's... You want to go, what were they thinking when they originally installed them? And cheers to you for doing that. So my question, so as someone, you may or may not know that I run a small theater here in Austin. So I'm wondering, did you offer those seats to any theaters here in town? Or what's happening with the old seating that's there?
Yeah, great question. That was my first hope, was that we would be able to pass them on to another organization. And we looked at it really closely and found that they are so far beyond their useful life that that would not be a good choice. We wouldn't wish those upon anyone. So the ultimate outcome was to recycle them, to break them down into their component parts and recycle all of the recyclable parts.
I will say, not to play devil's advocate, but it's what I do best. When I first started to equip Ground Floor Theater. I was originally going to do it as a proscenium, and I bought 150 used movie theater seats.
Bob, buying seats.
They were so disgusting. I can't imagine. I mean, these are movie theater seats from like the 60s. So you can imagine what I found in the crevices of those things. Well, that's very interesting. Is there anything else about the renovation that you want to highlight? I know you're updating HVAC and lobby movement area.
Yeah, that's absolutely right. Making some more space in the lobbies. The lobby of Bass Concert Hall got vastly expanded in the 2007 to 2009 renovation. So we're doing some more work within the existing footprint where we can make some creative adjustments just to create more space for folks when they come back, especially when we're trying to get everybody into the theater and out of the theater. New carpet throughout all of the lobbies and some really great kind of behind the scenes audio visual infrastructure upgrades so that we can offer the best possible opportunities to artists and designers. It'll set us up for more recording and live streaming in the future as well.
That's exciting.
That is exciting and so important. The technologies in specifically in audio and video are changing so rapidly, it's hard to keep up.
I have a question. With the seats changing in the balcony with the direction and everything, will it affect the sound or will it give you a better sound? Because you know your movement, you're facing a little bit of a different way.
Yeah, absolutely. We've been able to work with an acoustic consultant called Joffe Holden. They work all on venues all around the world to help us really think through the acoustic impacts of the changes that we're making and to do them in the optimal way. And so, yeah, that is our hope, that the acoustics will be really good in these new balcony seats.
That's exciting.
Well, wonderful. I am looking forward to sitting in the house at Bass Concert Hall. And what, Bob, do you know what the next show that I will be attending at Bass Concert Hall, what it is and when it is?
This coming 21-22 season is going to be our 40th. And we're going to announce that 40th season coming up here before too long. So stay tuned. We've already got our Broadway in Austin 21-22 season announced. So subscriptions are available for that.
And which is a great season this year.
And then we're going to share more of our programming soon.
Well, I look forward to that. I know that in the past that has been a press event in person at the theater. Will that happen again this year?
We are working on it.
Okay. Well, great. Bob Bercy, thank you so much for joining.
The landscape we live in.
Yes, indeed. It's an improvisational practice all the time.
It is.
Who knew that the Bass Concert Hall was Austin's fourth improv theater?
Yes, that's what it feels like.
Well, great. Well, thank you for joining us on Offstage and On the Air.
It was a great pleasure. Thanks again for having me.
Thank you awesome. So much.
We love our Bob Bercy.
We do. We do have to get him back on here and do a whole panel about creating shows and stuff like that.
Yeah, Oklahoma. I'm surprised that I did not know that. And I'm surprised they haven't done more to capitalize on that with,
well,
you know, with this position.
I brought it up. I brought it up to his publicist later that we really would like to do that interview and have a roundtable. And they thought it was a great idea. So we'll get back on that one.
We've talked about this, but I'm going to talk about it again. The Assassins, it's kind of a reunion. It's kind of a look forward on Zoom. It's three different Assassins casts, the 1990 world premiere, the 2004 revival that won a Tony, and then the upcoming Classic Stage Company version. It's got all three of their casts, plus some other people like Andre DeShields, Raul Esparza, Audra McDonald, and George Takei.
Raul was in one of the versions of it.
I believe he was. Yes, he was. He was. So
he was with MPH, I thought.
It looks very, very interesting. So this is going to be an hour-long program on April 15th. You can get information on the Classic Stage Company. But I love how it says, there's also one other person. I forgot to mention this person.
Ooh.
Hillary Clinton.
I thought she had joined the thing and then you didn't say anything. So I'm like, maybe I misread that story.
Yeah.
So I did not misread the story.
So we're going to hear from three John Wilkes Booths, three Squeaky Froms, and other people. So the three John Wilkes Booths are Victor Garber, Michael Service, and Steve Pasquale. And so I'm just going to do this. So the 1990 world premiere included Victor Garber, Patrick Cassidy, Greg German, Annie Golden, Lynn Green, Jonathan Hardley, Edie Corbidge, Terrence Mann, Deborah Monk, William Perry, and Lee Wilcoff.
What a cast.
2004 revival had Cerveris, Becky Ann Baker, Mario Cantone, Mary Catherine Garrison, Alexander Jim and Johnny, Ken Krugman, Mark Kudish, and Nathan, Dennis O'Hare, Chris Puglio, and Sally Wilford. And then the upcoming Classic Stage Company with Stephen Pasquale also includes Adam Chandler Barrett, Edie Cooper, Tavi Gevinson, Brad Giovine, Andy Grosselschen, I apologize, Andy, for that pronunciation, Bianca Horn, Judy Kuhn, Will K. Lee, Rob Morrison, Ethan Slater, Will Swenson, Wesley Taylor, Brandon Uranowitz, and Katrina Yuki. Let's take a little break. We'll be right back after these important messages. We are back. You're listening to Offstage and On the Air with me, Lisa.
And me, Nicole.
Sheps and Shiro. You're still listening to KOOP 91.7 on your FM dial, streaming live at koop.org. We had a great first of the half of the show with our guest, Bob Bursey, and lots of great talk. And I just a reminder, you probably don't even know this, Nicole.
What?
This is a pre-recorded show.
I had no clue. I've been showing up live each week.
All right. Okay. I've got a couple of things I really want to talk about, and hopefully we'll have time for both of them. But I want to talk about this. This was an article from brooklynrail.org by Christian Lewis. It says, one step forward, two steps back, Broadway's jagged little journey towards non-binary inclusion. And I realize this is just one article, but it's a very interesting one. So Jagged Little Pill started at ART in Cambridge, and it moved obviously to Broadway and is up for a zillion Tonys. Or, you know, whatever, if they ever happen.
I was like, words if they ever happen.
Right. Directed by Diana Paulus.
You should call it, they're up for a COVID Tony, whenever that'll happen.
When it played at ART, the character Joe was non-binary. And I should say that Joe is played by Lauren Pattern. Lauren Pattern is a cis woman. But when it moved to Broadway, they removed the non-binary aspect of it and just has Joe as a cis woman. It's kind of angering. According to this article, there's only been one other non-binary character on Broadway, and I'm trying to remember what it is because I didn't underline it. And this was going to be a sort of a chance to have a non-binary
character highlighted.
Representation on Broadway. And it's more, you know, about representation than having a character highlighted, which is basically the same thing. And it sort of goes to the point that we've talked about in previous shows where the Tony Awards have not changed their policy of presenting Best Actor and Best Actress. And replacing it instead with just a Best Actor category that is not gendered. So this makes it virtually impossible for a person that defines himself other than male or female to be nominated for a Tony Award, or they could be nominated, but they might
be in
have
a category
issues.
They don't want to be in.
Correct. So this was pretty huge. And so Joe was non-binary. There were tweets and things like that about the show about having a non-binary character, A, in a good way, and B, in not so good way by having a cis actor performing that, who's, by the way, going to win an Academy Award for featured actress in a musical. So there's a lot of stuff that they wanted to do. But Lauren Patton, the actor who plays the role, retweeted a lot of these things about having a non-binary character and sort of agreed with it. But then suddenly,
the good and the bad, or just one side?
I don't remember.
Okay. They were retweeting. That's fine.
But in her retweets, she would say, "Thank you for seeing what I hope to do with Joe."
Okay.
She is now denied saying those things in social media and pulled them off.
But Twitter lives forever. So that's good luck on that one, lady.
And then, of course, the decision is not hers. Decision was Diane Paulus to...
I was about to say, who made the decision? And was it based just on Tony solely? Or was it based on other stuff?
Oh, it was not based on Tony's. I mean, it's based on a lot of other things. But it was made by Diane Paulus. And it just seems so fraught. Anyway, and again, this is one article, this is one person's opinion, but if there's any truth to it, it really makes me upset. Standby, by the way, and I want to honor this person with her name, does identify as non-binary, and has gone on at least once. And
was her standby from ART to go to Broadway?
Correct. Yes. And so what this article is saying is that Diane Paulus and ART, you have a chance. You can redeem this when you reopen. Put this person, God, I'm so sorry. I don't have your name. I did not underline it, and my memory is terrible. That's the book writer.
Diablo Cody. Yeah, that's a book writer.
It's the book writer. So they could change it without changing the script, really. Just putting back in, they used they, them pronouns in the original. And all they'd have to do is put in the they, them
pronouns. As they go, to change the pronouns.
Yep. And they sing You Ought to Know, which has the lines, why won't you accept who I need to be? I need to know that I would be loved even when I am my true self.
Yeah.
So there's a lot of...
When you just said that song, I'm like, well, I mean, that just makes complete, absolute sense.
Yeah, there's a lot of things there. So let's take a brief break and listen to a little bit of You Ought to Know from Jagged Little Pill.
Let's.
I want you.
We're just going to jump into our next interview. We interviewed the folks from Performance Platform Austin about their organization and their upcoming untitled workshop. Here it is. Nicole, can you give me a leg up? I need to hop up on this platform.
I know. Hold on. Oh, I forgot the ladder. Here you go. Ready? I'm going to give you a boost. Ready?
Ah, thanks. And here, I'll just pull you up with my extra bullet strength arm.
Okay. Ah.
And here we are on Performance Platform.
And who are we
Performance Platform Austin. We are so fortunate to have a whole bunch of people here. We have Katie Bender. Hi, Katie.
Hi, guys.
Jerry Ruiz.
Hello.
Raul Garza.
Hi there.
And this absolute wonderful stars of the show, Giselle De La Rosa.
Hi, hi.
And Camila Munoz.
Hello.
Hi, all you guys. Well, two things. First of all, last night I saw Tales of a Blurred Ballerina, which I believe was your first project. Right. And until they came on my show a few weeks ago, I did not even know of your existence, which is why I wanted you to get on here. So I know that all of you are...
A little curious. We were like,
That's exactly what we were. So one of you, I don't care who it is, tell us about the organization that is Performance Platform Austin.
Yeah, so Performance Platform Austin started right after the beginning of the pandemic, when a bunch of theater makers in Austin got together and thought, you know, how can we support artists and theater in Austin during this time? And I am super fortunate to be fiscally sponsored through the Museum of Human Achievement every year. And so I get a little money from the city. And we thought that what would be really amazing would be to give the money to artists who were looking to explore new aspects of their craft while theaters were closed. So we, and Balanacea's piece, Tales of a Blurred Ballerina, was the first piece, and she got a chance to actually write, which she had never explored before, and work with the amazing choreographer Shade, and then this collaboration right now with Jerry and Raul and Camila and Giselle is a chance for them, and I'm kind of sneaking in the room as a dramaturg, to explore new aspects of practice and collaboration. So Performance Platform serves as seed money to artists to have some space to develop new aspects of craft. Yeah.
Awesome. So Performance Platform is a sponsor project of MOHA. I just like saying MOHA.
Me too.
The Museum of
what
Human
is it,
Achievement. MOHA.
Oh, okay.
Other than the four of you, who else are the who else is on the team?
So it is a bunch of amazing people: Sarah Saltwick, Jenny Connell Davis, Liz Fisher.
The incomparable Liz Fisher.
Incomparable, yes. Alexandra Basquiat-Shaw. And yes, I think
I have Kevin Munoz here as well.
And thank you very much for reminding me. Giselle and Kevin worked together to create the logo and the photos for our beautiful website, which would not be nearly as beautiful without their work.
Awesome. And what is that web address?
So that is
I can tell you if you want.
Please do.
It's performanceplatformatx.org. Well, I was really thrilled to do this because I really love the idea of nurturing artists in their field and allowing them the space to do that. Raul and Jerry, tell us about this project that you guys are working on, and Giselle and Camila. It sounds fascinating, sounds wonderful. Where are you in the process? Is there going to be a performance, et cetera?
All right, Jerry, you want to go first? You want me to go first?
Sure, I can lead us off. So Giselle and Raul and Katie have been kind of key collaborators and friends of mine ever since I moved to Austin 3 years ago. And I had known Katie Bender a little bit before, and I met Raul through a friend, and then I met Giselle through Raul. And I really had just wanted to work with all of them on a project. And I knew that Camila was a very talented actor. So the idea was, hey, we're in this pandemic, but maybe we can work together on a project that we'll create with and for Giselle and Camila, with me and Raul as a director playwright team. And I had really wanted to work a little bit with devising and a little bit with some joint stock methods. I've worked a lot on new plays, but usually I come into the project a little bit later after there's at least a rough draft from the playwright. So this was a chance for me to kind of get in on the ground floor of creating a piece and to work with just a really dynamic team of collaborators in creating a piece from its very inception.
Yeah, so go ahead, Raul.
Well, I'm the one who gets to kind of put pen to paper and bring this to life.
Lisa and me worked on kind of a devised piece when we made There and Back, which was a very interactive process of note-taking, scribing, musing, all that stuff. We started that from nothing here. And we're, you know, you asked how, where we are, we're kind of, we're on the journey and we're having fun along the journey. And we're finding our footing as we go and developing these characters. So we've got two performers and a multitude of mother-daughter characters that they're going to play together for us and bring generations to life in that dynamic that can only exist between a mother and a daughter.
Wonderful. And I'm hoping y'all can figure out how to do that, to dig in and to something to try to get the feel for being mother, daughter.
I'm struggling. can't figure it out.
Well, of course, you know, I've seen the two of you relate to one another as Giselle has done shows at our theater and Camila has come in. But I love the idea of you working together, which I have no personal experience with. So tell us how that is. Have you done it before? And how is it? How's the process right now?
Well, I have to say it's been such a treat. And, you know, I got into acting a handful of years ago, and I think Camila did too. And a lot of people are like, oh, Camila's taking, you know, she's just behind you, following your footsteps. And I'm like, sometimes I think I'm following her footsteps. She is one of my greatest teachers. And, you know, over the years, we've done like a couple of commercials together, but nothing in the theater world. So this is extra special. You know, I met Lisa and Raul at the same time with doing There and Back. And through Raul, I was able to meet Jerry and Katie around the same time, too. So, I mean, I have the same sentiments as Jerry of like wanting to work with these incredible people. And one of the things that I love about this community that I have learned in the community of Austin is they not only invite me, but they are always very welcoming of my family, which has been so important to me. And for them to see Camila in this capacity, not just as my daughter that I bring around, but as her own human, in her own humanness and her own creativeness and her own power. I mean, we're sitting in rehearsals and hearing what Camila has to say about something that we've just read or propose an idea. It's just, I'm always like, my heart beats a little bit faster. And I'm just like witnessing this as I look at her. And then I look in the computer and see her on the screen along with the other beautiful faces I get to look at. And it's wonderful. I love it.
Well, that's wonderful. You gave a little away when you said you were going to be playing multiple mother daughters. So it's just not going to be the two of you playing yourselves. Camila, tell us about some of the different mother-daughter teams that we will see when we are finally able to see this.
Wow. It's actually really fun to switch up. Like it's fun to like put myself in situations that I can see myself with my mom, but like totally have different reactions to what she says and bring totally different ideas to the conversation. And like some of the things that a few characters that I play say, I'm like, my mom would never let me say these things. Like,
I encourage a lot of things though.
Yeah, no, I'm like, I would never talk to her like this. And there's some parts where I'm like, oh yes, we had this conversation yesterday, but there's some things that I'm like, I could live a million lifetimes with her and I don't think I'd ever say this to her because some of the stuff is like pretty rude stuff. So I'm like, she deserves so much respect. She deserves so much gratitude for everything that she does for me. So I don't see, like, it's actually pretty fun for me to like step into this whole new light and figure out how I get to say these things, how I get to see her reactions when I say these things.
Yeah. Awesome.
Without getting in trouble. Just kidding.
Without the getting in trouble part.
Well, we don't have a whole bunch of time left, but Katie, you're operating as not only, you know, one of the producers of the piece and the project, but you're the dramaturg for this piece, correct? Yeah. So I have a question. Did you have a mother ever? And are you a mother? And how are you using that to help this team with their piece?
Yeah, good question. I sprung fully grown from the head of a goat many years ago.
I knew there was something about you.
I have a mother who I look just like, and I have a daughter who looks just like me. So I am very much right smack in the middle of this experience. And one of the greatest pleasures to me of this experience has been we've all reached out to different mothers or daughters that we know and have interviewed them about their experiences, and specifically about their experiences of being a mother-daughter in pandemic. And we have gotten like so many amazing stories, but also so much love and respect, and a lot of mothers talking about ways in which they've gotten to know their daughters in a new light in this time.
Sure.
So yeah, I mean, dramaturging it has been a real joy, and also like in a lot of ways has helped get through this time in which I do not have rehearsals, and so do not have a chance to experience myself as anything other than a mother or wife inside my house.
Got it. Yeah. And what, in our last few minutes, is there going to be a chance for the public to see this piece, and how would people get information? Give me the 411 on that.
Yeah. So we've just been talking about we're going to do a reading in September, September 20th, it looks like. And the hope is that we would invite a bunch of people out, and hopefully, like Tales of a Blurred Ballerina, this piece would then get a production by a real production company. And you can get more information through the website or the PPA Facebook posts.
Wonderful.
Which I will put up.
One important thing to know is the kind of the lens through which we examine these mom and daughter relationships, which is influenced by Latinx moms and daughters in our hometown, spanning multiple generations. So we wanted to explore that and what makes them so unique and so vital to the social justice movement we have, and how are they doing in the pandemic. So that's another really cool POV to enjoy this in.
Yeah, the Absolutely. Whole play is set in Rainy Street across generations of a Mexican-American family that's lived in that neighborhood.
I have to tell you, I do miss the old Rainy Street. It was such a charming little block back then.
Yeah.
Well, great. So, and what are the plans for Performance Platform post unnamed mother-daughter? Do you plan to continue on with new projects?
That's a question. I think it depends on there being a need in Austin for seed money for artists for development. And okay. That's an open-ended question. I don't yet know.
Fair enough. If I were to have a vote, I would say keep going. We need to be able to develop. Our artists need to be able to develop. So one of the things that has come out of this pandemic is there's a lot more artists in residency programs. So that's great.
Yeah.
Well, thank you guys so much for coming on. I wish I could talk to y'all. I mean, we could talk forever. There's just so much to discuss and such a great group of people. Thank you and good luck with everything. And I cannot wait to see this in whatever form I'm able to see it in.
Yes, thank you.
Thank you so much, y'all.
Thanks, everybody.
I hope we have time for this article because it was another really good one. It was called Climb the Ladder, and it was in today's briefing, and it's from Dance Magazine. And it shows how choreographers in Broadway get to that role. And basically, they all sort of go the same route, which
Isn't
I thought was...
strange? It really is the same path almost all these years later, like in the way you can do things different as an actor, but in this one world, it's really just the same old path.
And in the world of dance, it's unique. So it's not the same way in ballet or dance companies or anything like that. So, you know, you have to, typically you go from, you know, dancer to dance captain. Tell people what a dance captain is.
The dance captain helps all the rehearsals, helps keep things clean, does all the little tests and marks before the show and keeps things smooth and running. It's little eyes and ears.
And they're usually in the show.
In the show. Yeah. So they're there every day and then they're the person in the room where it happens.
Yep. They are in the room where it happens. Then they go to assistant choreographer, who is the person. It's really kind of a operational job. They're taking notes and things like that. They are assisting the choreographer in any way that the choreographer needs. And then they go to associate choreographer.
Yeah. Yep.
Which at that point you're given the task to, you know, maybe choreograph a number or a piece of a number or a dance break.
I need you for 16 bars of this song. Give it to me.
Mm-hmm. And it's more of a collaborative effort with the choreographer. And then you go to main choreographer. And I thought that was very interesting. They talked to Susan Stroman a lot, who I name drop a lot as somebody that I've worked with several times in the past. But here's what you need to do at each step. So when you're dance captain, you need to make yourself indispensable so that the performance cannot live without you.
I can understand that. That makes sense to me.
Right. And then be a collaborative partner, but know when to say something. So it's that you got to know when to open your mouth and when to keep your mouth shut. Here's where I would get screwed up. Be organized. Here's an interesting thing. This is where the dance captain, all three of those, dance captain, associate choreographer, assistant choreographer, is very like a stage manager. You have to be a sympathetic middleman. You are a middle person, like between, and I'm using air quotes, management and cast. So you have to walk that line. And as an ex-stage manager, it's a difficult line to walk. And if you do it well, which I think I did.
It's also, I think, difficult too when you're a dance captain because you are in the show.
I did not know this. The Stage Directors and Choreographers Foundation, which used to be called SSDNC, but now it's not, offers an apprenticeship opportunity called the Observation Program, where they get early and mid-career choreographers. They get to work with master choreographies.
Oh, that's really fascinating.
Pretty amazing.
Yeah.
So we also have some sad news to talk about. And locally, we lost one of our own, Jason Connor.
Jason was a doll. I was lucky enough. He was one of the first people like you, Lisa, that I met when I moved here. And you may know him from playing a lot of shows and working at Zach, being a part of the Biscuit Brothers. He made a lot of appearances on the Biscuit Brothers. He and Meredith McCall do a lot of shows at the North Door. He was an educator, a music educator, and just a kind-hearted, wonderful individual who is talented. You may most recognize him for Santa Land, doing all the lovely music and little shows before him, but big loss, big, big loss.
All right, we're going to leave you today with a little nod to the choreography article, and we're going to play from White Christmas movie, not the show because it wasn't in the show, Choreography, which is one of my favorite numbers from that movie.
Me too.
It's fun. See you guys. We'll see you next week when we look what's happening off stage and on the air. Bye.
Chaps, who did taps? Aren't tapping anymore. They're doing choreography. Chicks.